From newsounds.org, this is a special edition of the Soundcheck podcast. I'm John Schaefer. This past weekend, the American pianist Leon Fleischer passed away. Now, if you're not familiar with Fleischer's story, he wasn't just one of the great American classical pianists of the 20th century. He was also one of the great classical pianists of the early 21st century, which was totally unexpected for reasons that will become clear as we tell his story through an interview that we did in 2004 and again in 2008. We've conflated the two of them for this special edition of the Soundcheck podcast. You're hearing Leon Fleischer performing at the piano. He has for many years been performing this piece, Ravel's Concerto for the Left Hand Alone. Leon Fleischer's career began auspiciously enough. Keyboard studies at 4, his first public recital at 8, he studied with the legendary Arthur Schnabel, and then in 1964, at the height of his powers, began to be unable to play with his right hand. It was initially diagnosed as repetitive stress syndrome, and it was only 30 years later that Leon Fleischer was more properly diagnosed with focal dystonia, a neurological ailment from which he has received relief through Botox shots, and he has now resurrected his career as a two-handed pianist, although he continues to perform the left-hand repertoire as well. Leon Fleischer joins me here in our WNYC studio on Soundcheck in advance of a couple of performances, again with the New York Philharmonic, of this Ravel Concerto for the Left Hand Alone. Leon Fleischer, thank you for being here this afternoon.
John, I'm utterly amazed how you've been able to capsulize my life. You know, 75 years in what, 18 seconds?
I'm sorry about that.
No, I'm amazed. I think it's absolutely marvelous. I couldn't do it myself.
Well, I have to ask, you know, for 30 years, for 30 of the best years of your career, between, say, the ages of the 30s and the 60s, You were only able to play the left-hand piano repertoire. Right. First of all, many people are going to be wondering, there's left-hand piano repertoire?
Yeah, that's an amazement. Thanks mostly, actually, to a man called Paul Wittgenstein, who in the First World War, on being unfortunately on the wrong side, lost his right arm. Mm-hmm. But happily, quite a wealthy man and an obsessive compulsive, obviously, was able and very willing to commission the great composers of his day to write music for his left hand and orchestra.
And he apparently had a prodigious left-handed technique. I mean, this Ravel piano concerto, if you didn't know better, you would say, oh, that's a pianist.
Well, that's Ravel's goal in this, his stated goal, actually. He said that. He said that, I want this piece to sound that if you listen to it with your eyes closed, that you remark that there is nothing amiss, that there's nothing unusual.
And Prokofiev wrote a piece for this person.
I never heard Wittgenstein, although he lived in my time, but I'd never heard him. There is one record that I have heard that I think is kind of past his prime a little bit. He was very unhappy with most of these pieces. He did not like them. He fought with Ravel about the Ravel. Yes, he said it was much too much orchestra. He wasn't paying him all that money to write such a big piece for orchestra. Mm. He wanted it mostly for left hand. He never played the Prokofiev. He looked at it, locked it up in a cupboard drawer, and it wasn't unlocked until East German soldier after World War II, who had lost his right arm in that conflict, got in touch with Mrs. Prokofiev, and she unlocked the drawer and let him play the piece. He was a curmudgeon with Mr. Wittgenstein. I think the only composer that he really liked that wrote for him was an Austrian composer called Franz Schmidt, who wrote lots of tuneful, chromatic, you know, kind of Bally High kind of things, you know.
Well, maybe despite his best efforts, though, no. There is a sizable body of,
there
of
is.
Substantial
and,
works.
And I might add, I'm to a certain extent responsible myself. Some composers today have written a bunch of concertos and solo and chamber music repertoire for me and my left hand.
Yeah. Now, that's a very practical response on your part to not being able to use the right hand for all those years. What about, did you find that there was on some emotional or personal level a way that you could continue to respond to music even when you didn't have all 10 fingers available to play it?
Yeah, that puts the question very nicely. Yes, when this happened, and it was, as you say, at the height of my rather swinging career at the time, I was 35, 36, and this dystonia, that's an average age when dystonia hits, when it does hit. I was in a state of despair for a couple of years, deep despair. And it wasn't until I realized that my connection to music was more than just as a two-handed piano player. Music really was my life. So that awareness, that sudden aha moment, suddenly enabled me to face the fact that I couldn't play with my right hand, so that I would investigate the left-hand literature. I started to conduct, and I still keep that activity quite actively. And I became a very serious teacher, and I credit the dystonia really with forcing me into a position of being able to understand and analyze and be aware what music making is about.
Well, it is about communicating, and if you can't communicate one way and you are a genuinely musical person, I assume you will find other ways to communicate.
Why,
that.
Thank you, sir.
So the I understand your teachers call you the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the keyboard.
Well,
your students.
I feel more like Darth Vader usually.
So some of your students have gone on to great acclaim. I mean, Andre Watts studied with you.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate. Many really gifted younger people of our time have chosen to play for me. Fema Bronfman. Mm-hmm. Louis Lorty, Lauren Holland. There are a whole bunch that I needn't enumerate.
Yeah. Well, now, tell me how it happened that finally, 30 years after losing the ability to play with the right hand, you suddenly got the proper diagnosis and discovered the Botox treatment.
Well, I searched high and low, far and wide, Western medicine, Eastern medicine, Northern medicine, Southern medicine.
Were you visiting shamans?
Yes. Oh, I have an extraordinary photograph. It's on my piano of Lenny Bernstein at his most shamanesque, pouring with the most intense concentration on his face, pouring a glass of scotch on my right hand to exorcise its demons.
Uh-huh.
It's a great photograph. No, I looked everywhere, and I found relief in certain alternative therapies like Rolfing. But it wasn't until I was told that at NIH, National Institutes of Health down in Bethesda, they had a program using Botox, a program for musicians with dystonia. They had isolated, it was no longer repetitive stress syndrome. Some people even called it carpal tunnel. They had isolated the problem. It is a neurological disorder where the brain gives an uncontrollable and unwanted instruction to a muscle to contract. That it happens to be a task-specific illness is kind of the wonder of it all.
Yeah.
You know, it strikes surgeons, it strikes computer workers, anybody who does detailed small muscle work under stress. We are really small muscle athletes. We really are, but we don't have a disabled list.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Right.
And being a dystonic, which I call myself, we don't have a 12-step program, you know.
But you do have the Botox, which...
do have the Botox.
Which has
which
given
is,
you...
Which helps alleviate the symptoms. Actually, the way the Botox works is that they inject it into the forearm for me.
Mm-hmm.
My fifth and fourth fingers on my right hand would curl under involuntarily. And what's ironic about all of this is that there's no pain.
Hmm.
Isn't that curious? There's no pain. They inject the Botox into the point where the nerve informs the muscle to contract. And the Botox erects a kind of barrier preventing that message to go through. And the muscle of the finger can stay extended,
mm-hmm.
won't curl under.
But there are times when you will want to, you know, curl to
Oh, yes, you can do that. You can use it at will.
Okay.
Right.
And how long does that barrier that the Botox creates
That shot, last? The shot usually lasts anywhere from 6 to 8 months. And it has, thank goodness, no side effects. And is in a sense, endlessly repeatable.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing after a certain number of repetitions, in some cases they've found a slight weakness occurs. I mean, it is, you know, it's botulinum toxin.
Yeah,
type
yeah.
A.
So, I mean, this on the one hand, this must have just been an amazing experience to be able to go back to two-handed piano repertoire.
Oh.
On the other hand, you want to be careful what you're doing, and so you've taken it kind of a step-by-step approach.
And actually, there are things that I can't do the way I would like to do, so I have to kind of pick and choose my repertoire a little bit.
Leon Fleischer is my guest, the great American pianist, made a number of recordings back in the 50s and 60s that have just been reissued. They had previously been available only on LP. They had never been reissued on CD before. How do you feel about having those old records out now?
It's a strange feeling. You know, I haven't listened to my old records in decades, almost since the time they were made. I've made new records, and what I do now, I think, is different than what I did then. The athletic aspect of it then might have been more brilliant and seizing, as it were, but I would hope there's some compensatory values that have accrued over the years.
Mm. Well, why don't we actually listen to a little bit of your 1956 recording of the Schubert Piano Sonata in B flat major, and we can compare that to the 2004 recording that you made. This is Leon Fleischer and a little bit of music by Schubert. Some of the 1956 recording by my guest Leon Fleischer of the Schubert Piano Sonata in B-flat major that's been newly and finally reissued by Sony. Now here is Leon's 2004 recording from the album we were talking about called Two Hands of the same piece. Thank you. Leon Fleischer from his 2004 recording Two Hands. So in between these two recordings, you had the passage of almost half a century, and Leon Fleischer battling focal dystonia and the loss of the use of his right hand for much of his career, coming back in 2004 with that. And Leon, as you said, maybe the athleticism of the early recording is more obvious, but you would hope that there was something compensatory in the new one. Critics have noted a kind of emotional core in that Two Hands recording, in your recent recordings and performances in general. Is that, do you agree? Is that the compensatory element that you hear?
John, you really, you're trapping me here. You've got me in a corner.
I guess there is no good answer to that, is there?
No, it's really not for me to say, what has happened to me and how I've dealt with it and how I've grown or what you will, that's for other people to judge. I'm involved with the process, as I said. I hear a difference. I hear a difference, if you will.
And yeah, is it more of a physical difference or a mental / emotional one?
No, yeah, or spiritual, whatever you want to call it. It's perhaps a greater awareness of the greater number of implications of the notes. I think that's what happens with time.
You are continuing to perform the left-handed piano repertoire, including this Ravel concerto, which clearly you must love because you have played it by your own count more than 1,000 times.
Yeah, I've done it a lot of times. Well, I gave a recital last night in Boston at Jordan Hall, and I gave a program of what I call music of three hands, meaning I play two-handed music and I play also one-handed music. So there are some very good pieces for left hand alone.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to make a judicious mix of the program.
Well, now you're launching this Freedom to Play tour. Tell us a little bit about that, because you are not the only musician to have come across this problem.
There are some 10,000 musicians in this country. They've identified, I think, about 300,000 people with dystonia.
Mm-hmm.
I am honored to be chosen to lead this program, this Freedom to Play. I go around the country, I go around the world for that matter. I'm going in a few weeks to Rome and address not only young musicians in conservatories, but I address the medical community, because you'd be amazed how many doctors out there might have just, vaguely dystonia, many of them think it's a country somewhere in Lower Slobovia. But the medical community has to be made aware of this and the possible treatments. And there are treatments that alleviate the symptoms. They know the gene on the brain where genetic dystonia occurs, DYT1, it's called. They don't know yet really how to cure it. So I'm trying to raise awareness of the fact that it exists, how to deal with it, and what to do when you do discover.
And so is it also an attempt on your part to raise awareness among musicians who are having may have been misdiagnosed as carpal tunnel or repetitive stress?
Exactly. And for some reason, it's very understandable. Many musicians are very secretive about it. If it gets out that, their chops are not where they should be, they lose the work. Being a solo artist at the time, I was faced somewhat with that, but my nature, I kind of rose up on my hind legs and started screaming when this happened. And eventually, they found a way to make it, it's now a subset. I think music medicine is now a subset of sports medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, as you say, you as a pianist, you are a small muscle athlete.
Right.
So there's definitely a lot of crossover there.
A lot of how one successfully deals with keeping muscles in shape.
Yeah. And we talk about certain piano pieces as being real works of stamina. I mean, a lot of the same terms that we use in sports, we use in music.
The main thing that I would recommend to young musicians to think about, if you go to a ball game 1 or 2 hours before the game starts, what do you find out there? You find all these players out in the outfield stretching, stretching. What piano teacher or fiddle teacher or any musical instrument teacher tells their students, stop after 45 minutes, hour max, and stretch. Stretch. Terribly important.
How important, I mean, when you look back at some of the younger pianists that you've mentored over the years, how satisfying is that compared to having done a great recording or given a great concert?
Oh, it's unspeakably satisfying, because when passes on to the next generation, it's, in a sense, a touch of immortality, which I think eventually, or on one level or another, most of us kind of aspire to.
So you hear echoes of your own take on music, that spirit that you were talking about in some of these younger pianists.
Yes, it's very satisfying, I assure you.
We are listening to a kind of getting the opportunity to hear some of Leon Fleischer's early records that have just now made it onto CD. It was interesting to hear the Schubert back-to-back, the 2004 recording with the one from the 50s. Let's do the same thing with this Debussy Clair de Lune for piano. Less of an athletic work, Leon, than the Schubert piano sonata. So is there much of a difference in the way that you approach this piece, some 45 years later?
Play it. Let me hear.
Okay. Let's hear. This is the 1959 recording first, Leon Fleischer and Claire
DeVille. The ultimate sadism would be for you to not tell me which is which.
Darn it, I should have thought of that.
Yes. All right. Yeah,
well, I've already let the cat out of the bag. This is young Leon Fleischer here.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, thank you.
'59, recording by Leon Fleischer of Debussy's Clair de Lune. Now here is the same piece, the same pianist, 45 years later, from Leon's record called Two Hands. Debussy's Clair de Lune, two recordings by Leon Fleischer, separated by 4.5 decades. And Leon, I asked you, if there was a difference in your approach. I kind of expected you to say, no, there isn't. Because to me, the striking thing about this is how consistent the approach is and the sound between these two Leon Fleischers, separated by so much time. Now, if you haven't heard that earlier recording in a number of years, do you hear something different there?
A little bit. It's really, in a sense, John, difficult to say because you've dovetailed these two performances. In other words, the newer one takes over where the old one left off.
Right.
I would have been able to, had you just repeated the same material, it would have been easier for me to make some kind of a comparison there. There is perhaps a brightness or a brilliance to the first that is not there in the second. And I must say, I think I prefer the second in that there is a more ephemeral quality, a little bit less real, the later performance, which at this time in my life I think I prefer.
And there is a Dystonia Foundation website that people can go to.
There is www.dystonia/foundation.com.
Dystonia-foundation.
How computer literate I am.
Thank you, John. You got to be sure of those dash slash things. Completely different keystrokes.
Yeah. I just like to add something. I'm opening my stint with the Philharmonic on May 27th, and my son Julian is opening. I play at 7:30. He starts at 9:30 at Joe's Pub.
Really?
So I just wanted to throw
Well, now,
that
what
in.
Is he playing?
He sings.
He sings.
He's a highly, highly gifted young stylist.
Very good. Yeah. Julian Fleischer at Joe's Pub.
Yes, and his rather big band.
On May 27th.
Right.
Proud dad Leon Fleischer has been our guest on Soundcheck. Here he is once again performing the Ravel Concerto for the Left Hand, the piece that he will be playing May 27th, 28th, and 29th. Once again, for information on the Dystonia Medical Research Foundation, it's dystonia-foundation.org. Leon Fleischer, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, John.
The American pianist Leon Fleischer passed away this weekend, and we've been remembering him with this special edition of the Soundcheck podcast. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our producer is Karen Havlick. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us. You can hear more and watch videos of live in-studio performances on our website at newsounds.org.